You don't assume that we can read what's in.
Of course not.
Okay.
But I'm assuming you can read what's on your...
But not, yes, but not inside of the same picture. Because
yeah, okay. It's okay. So, I again, my apologies. It's a talk I worked on very hard, but it was a while ago, and I don't remember the details.
Okay.
Okay? Now, and I definitely don't remember the order of the slides, definitely not the order of the jokes. Anyway, here's the bigger picture. So let's start with the bigger picture. So, there is a bigger picture, and it's roughly a 3x4 grid. Okay? And if you look at it, sort of very, it's I think the second page on your handout. You'll find that there are three columns titled U knots, V knots, and W knots. And each column has topology, combinatorics, low algebra, and high algebra. And for each of these, so each column corresponds to a class of knots, be it U knot, which stands for usual knots, or V knot, which stands for virtual knots, or W knot, which is what I'm going to talk about today, and it stands for either welded knot or weakly virtual knots or warm-up knots. But in any case, it starts with W. And each one has a topology, and I'll say something about the topology, and some associated combinatorics, and then some associated low algebra. And the low algebra is somehow a statement about the relationship between the combinatorics and a certain class of Lie algebras. So for the case of U knots, it's metrized Lie algebras. For the case of V knots, it's Lie bialgebras. And for the case of W knots, it's arbitrary Lie algebras. Okay? And then in each case, there's always the same question. The question is, construct a universal invariant. All of this will be explained if I don't get distracted or if I don't mess up. I mean, all of it should be explained. What?
You're distracted.
I am distracted. Good. You know, David, the video just captured you, so therefore it will also capture me telling you that I have a 13 years old son. With the exact same attitude. Anyway, sorry. So in all cases, there is the question of constructing a universal invariant in the handout. And the universal invariant, and it's always a question about solving equations in a number of unknowns which are written in this combinatorial language, and therefore they correspond to solving equations with certain unknowns in either Lie algebras or Lie bialgebras, or sorry, metrized Lie algebras or Lie bialgebras or arbitrary Lie algebras. And in each case of knots, it's a different set of equations. In each class of knots, it's a different set of equations and a different set of unknowns. And in the case of usual knots, the high algebra turns out to be the Drinkful theory of associators. In the case of virtual knots, it should turn out to be the Ettinghoff-Kashdan theory of quantization of Lie bialgebras. But if you look at the middle column, you see that it's the most crooked, and you know, sort of the least straight one, and indeed so. Okay? And finally, in the case of W knots, which is what I'm going to talk about today, the problem ends up being the Kashiwara-Wern problem. The Lie theoretic problem being solved turns out to be the Kashiwara-Wern problem. Finally, there are maps from U knots to V knots to W knots, and therefore there are relations between these problems which a priori you would not expect. So associators are related to Lie bialgebras, are related to Kashiwara-Wern. Part of it is well known, part of it is not yet done, but certainly that explains the relationship. Okay? Anyway, so that was sort of the global map. Now let's talk about the map of today's lecture. So I'm going to tell you that a certain statement about convolutions in Lie algebras and Lie groups is equivalent to a certain non-theoretic statement. There are two routes by which you could go. Well, first of all, the non-theoretic statement is equivalent to that to a diagrammatic statement. I will explain it, okay? And then from the diagrammatic statement, there are two routes to go to the convolution statement. One route is to say this diagrammatic statement is equivalent to a certain statement by Alexeyev and Torossian, which they prove is equivalent to a certain conjecture by Kashiwara and Verne about free Lie algebras, which Kashiwara Verne relates to the convolutions statement. You see, this goes sideways and it's highly indirect. Okay? And in fact, if you follow the statements, they are ugly, and it's very hard to really sort of, it's very hard to see that the statements are of the same shape, really. Okay? Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go via a more direct route, and I'm going to translate the diagrammatic statement to an algebraic statement, then to a statement about unitary operators, then to a statement about the group algebra of a Lie group, and then to a statement about convolutions. And the advantage is that when you look at these statements, so in fact those statements are the left column of your handout, of the page 3 of your handout, I think. So the 6 statements appear one after the other in the left column, and if you look at it, they are all of the exact same shape. So beyond the first two, they all have, we need to find something that satisfies property 1, 2, and 3, and I'll just translate properties 1, 2, and 3 from language to language until they move from a unitary language to a non-theoretic statement. Okay? So it's much, much cleaner. Unfortunately, it's less rigorous. So that's the price you pay for beauty, for what I consider as beauty. So I suppose that's an apology. Okay? Anyway, just very briefly, this is the free Lie statement, the Kashiwara-Verne statement. You can see the formulas, which, as promised, are not terribly nice. And here's the Alexeyev-Torossian statement. Well, it's kind of nicer, except the definitions are hidden. So again, you don't see very clearly the relationship with Lie algebras. And now I can move on to really my talk. Okay? So my plan is to go over my talk twice. So I'm going to go down this column of morally equivalent statements quickly the first time, and then backwards from the bottom up more slowly with more details. And you're of course always welcome to interrupt. So first of all, the convolutions statement says the following. It says, suppose you have a Lie group G, finite dimensional, with Lie algebra also G, calligraphic Gothic G, I suppose. Okay? Well, there is always a map called the exponential map going from the Lie algebra, where is it here? Here, X. There is always a map going from the Lie algebra to the Lie group. Okay? And therefore, if you have functions on the Lie group, you can pull them back to functions on the Lie algebra. Okay? And then the statement is that this pullback operation is an isomorphism, or at least a local isomorphism, that takes the algebra under convolution of invariant functions on the Lie group to the algebra under convolution of invariant functions on the Lie algebra. Okay? So let's say it again. So if you have two functions on the group, so f and g belong to fun g, or fun g, I don't know. In Italian it's fun g, and in otherwise it's fun g. So if you have two such functions which are invariant under conjugation and are supported near the identity, then if you take their convolution on the group and then pull back to the Lie algebra, you get the same thing as if you take the if you put back to the Lie algebra and then take the convolution over there. Okay? And I didn't state that when pulling back, you also have to multiply by a certain numerical factor, certain normalization factor, which is the square root of the Jacobian of the exponential map. Okay? And my rule, what? My rule is that I will put less stress on the harder parts of the talk, which is the stuff about Jacobians. And therefore it will be in green. So everything that is in green definitely can be ignored on first pass. Okay? Though it's harder and nicer in some ways. Anyway, so that's the statement. Are you okay with the statement?
So one convolution is just addition, and the other is conversion to the equal?
Yeah. So convolution using the operation addition, and the other one is convolution using the multiplication in the equal. And with integration using harmony. Okay. Well, the second statement, and again, since this is first pass, I'm not going to say it too clearly, goes as follows. So you see, if you have a finite group, then functions on the group, is isomorphic to the group ring of that group. Okay? And the convolution product over here becomes the convolution that becomes ordinary multiplication in the group ring. Okay? Now, what's the group ring of a Lie group? So I claim that in some sense the group ring of a Lie group, so the group ring of a Lie group is the universal enveloping algebra of its Lie algebra. Well, you have to complete it in a certain way, and I will not, at the moment, will not tell you how. Okay? But why is it so? So what's the property of the group ring? It's a certain algebra that contains the group, and into which the group maps injectively. Okay? So, indeed, the universal enveloping algebra contains the group by mapping an element of the group, which is considered as the exponential of a Lie algebra element, to this exponential considered formally as an element of the universal enveloping algebra. Completed, because it's a finite infinite sum. Okay? So, and indeed the product in the group becomes the product over here, so it's a homomorphism. And this is indeed an algebra, and you can show that this is injective. Okay? So in some sense, the universal enveloping algebra is a replacement for the group ring. So, I had a statement about convolutions over here. Convolutions become multiplication here. So it also becomes multiplication, so you can translate the statement to a statement about multiplication in the universal enveloping algebra. Well, there is a likewise state, there is a like statement for the Lie algebra. So functions on the Lie algebra correspond to the group ring of the Lie algebra, which corresponds to the symmetric algebra completed of the Lie algebra. And so I can translate the statement like that I had at the beginning to a certain equality that happens here and here. And given that I'm talking about integration, sort of given that I've switched from summation, and that the operation going from functions to the group ring is a certain summation operation. You take every element times its coefficient. Okay? So summations become integrations, and you get a statement like this. The statement you end up needing to prove is the statement written over here. So let me just read that statement, and the justification will come later. So the statement is that if you have two functions on the Lie algebra, which have a small support, so they're supported near zero, and they are ad-invariant, so this is the upper G here, it means invariant, and the functions are called phi and psi, then ignore green stuff. So the green stuff is what became of the Jacobians of before, so just ignore it. Then the integral over the Lie algebra cross itself of one function times, of phi of x times psi of y times the exponential of e to the, of x plus y, so this is somehow the thing that replaces convolution on the Lie algebra, is equal to the integral on the Lie algebra squared of phi of x psi of y of e to the x times e to the y. This is now a non-commutative product because we are in the universal enveloping algebra, and that's what replaced convolution on the Lie group. Okay? So that's my second statement. Okay? And that's the statement that I will try to prove. Okay. Now, the third statement. So again, this is still at sketch level. So, how do you prove? So the statement we have to prove is that two integrals are equal to each other. Okay? One way of proving that two integrals are equal to each other is to prove that you can find a measure-preserving transformation that pulls the integrand in one case to the integrand in the other case. Well, in fact, I have these normalization factors, so rather than a measure-preserving transformation, it should be a measure-compressing transformation with a fixed compression factor, with a fixed Jacobian, okay? Now, a measure-preserving transformation induces a unitary operator on L2, and so I can translate this question to a question about the existence of a certain unitary operator. And this question already fits the pattern 1, 2, 3 that all other formulations have. And so let me read it to you. So the claim is that, so the unitary statement says that there is a function omega, which is invariant on the Lie algebra, and a tangential differential operator. So tangential, I think I should explain it later, but it's a differential operator in which all the differentiations are tangent to the orbits. And this I have to have because I want my identity to hold for every psi and phi. Okay, so there is a tangential differential operator V, which is defined on functions on the Lie algebra cross itself, with the following properties. Okay, so the first property, well, the most, the only one in black, so the only one you really need to understand, is the following. Well, first of all, whenever you have a differential operator acting on functions, you can tensor with any vector space, and you have a differential operator acting on functions with values in that vector space. Essentially, if you have the Laplacian acting on functions, you can generalize it to the Laplacian acting on vector-valued functions. It's always the same. Okay? So, instead of looking at functions with values in the real numbers, okay, so V is an operator on functions with values in the real numbers, okay? But generalize it to functions with values in the universal enveloping algebra. Again, by tensoring with the universal enveloping algebra, by not doing anything interesting. Okay? Now, there are two special functions on the universal with values in the universal enveloping algebra. One function is, well, you take x and y. So I'm describing two special functions that are functions from the Lie algebra cross itself into the universal enveloping algebra. So the subscript x here just means that when I refer to this copy of the Lie algebra, I use the variable x, and when I refer to this copy of the Lie algebra, I use the variable y. So one function is the function that will map the pair xy to the exponential of x plus y, and the other function will map the pair xy to e to the x, e to the y. Okay? Both of these are functions on the Lie algebra cross itself, and therefore they induce multiplication operators. Okay, whenever you have a function, you can look at the corresponding multiplication operator. And what I want, the condition that I want, is that z composed with the multiplication operator by e to the x plus y will be equal to the multiplication operator of e to the x, e to the y, composed with v. So that's the primary condition. Okay? And then I have, and again, this is the condition which is parallel to the statement that the measure-preserving transformation that I'm seeking should pull back e to the x plus y to e to the x, e to the y. So it should pull back one integrand to the other. And then I have unitarity, and I have that v acting on omega evaluated on x plus y should be omega evaluated on x times omega evaluated on y, where omega is this function that I'm also looking for, that I'm also seeking. Okay? And this will be the corresponding, the thing corresponding to having the correct compression factor.
The same omega, the x plus y upstairs, it's not the same problem.
What? So the thing that's changed from the formula upstairs to the formula here is that here I specified what omega is. No, it is the same, in fact. So the thing is, so omega is secretly the square root of the Jacobian. But at the moment I'm having no prejudice. I'm saying let's look for an omega. If I have an omega with these properties, I will have a homomorphism, and then between the convolution algebras, and then later I will compute what omega is, and it will turn out to be the square root of the Jacobian. Okay? So I have two, so I'm looking for two things. I'm looking for a tangential differential operator V with n for a function, if you want just a multiplication operator, which have a certain collection of commutation relations. Okay? So now let's move on to the next statement and do it a little bit more quickly so that I can go to the last statement and then move backwards more slowly. Okay, that's my plan. So the idea is that, again, I'm looking for a differential operator acting on functions on a Lie algebra. But you see, if you have a Lie algebra acts on itself. So every element of the Lie algebra also acts on, by via the adjoint action, acts on the Lie algebra. Okay? So every element of the Lie algebra, defines a vector field on the Lie algebra. And that vector field, you can use it to differentiate. Okay? So, elements of the Lie algebra give you tangential differential operators. Likewise, elements of the dual Lie algebra give you functions on the Lie algebra, because an element of the dual Lie algebra is just a function on the Lie algebra. Now, if you take any word, so take a word phi 1, phi 2, x 1, x 2, phi 3. So this is a word in which the first letter is in the dual Lie algebra, the second is in the dual, the third is in the Lie algebra, and this is in the Lie algebra, this is in the dual. So that defines an operator, because you first multiply by these functions, and you differentiate with respect to this, then you differentiate with respect to this, and you multiply with. So basically, words in the Lie algebra and its dual define differential operators. Okay? So, my next formulation is that I am looking for an element V inside the universal enveloping algebra of IG. IG is essentially the Lie algebra times its dual, semi-direct product with its dual.
Coadjoint action.
So I'm looking for an element in the universal envelope. So essentially I'm looking for a word in the letters that come from G dual and G. But I'm looking for two such words because it's the second tensor power. So in other words, I'm looking for a differential operator acting on G tensor G. And I want this differential operator to satisfy three equations. And these equations are the direct translations of the equations written up here. So first of all, you interpret e to the x and e to the x times y. You interpret them using this language, and they become a certain element, uppercase R, which in itself is an element in this tensor product of universal enveloping algebras. And then I want V acting on delta tensor 1 of R, which is exactly this, to be equal to, well, again, this is first pass, so I'm not doing it in detail, but the idea is clear. Likewise, you know, V conjugate, so what's the adjoint of a thing like that? Well, the adjoint of a multiplication function is to do nothing. The adjoint of differentiation is negative delta differentiation. Okay? So the unitarity statement can also be translated to an algebraic statement, and also the last one. Okay? So now my... So I think that the point is that now my unknown is an element of the universal enveloping algebra of G direct sum or semi-direct product G dual. Okay. Next. Well, the point is that well, if you want to find an element of U of G times G dual, maybe tensor squared, and you want to find it so that it will work for all the algebras, okay, it's best if you can find it in terms of a universal formula. Now, what's a universal formula? Well, how do you get universal formulas for things in this space? Well, first of all, trees definitely represent formulas in Lie algebras. And also, wheels. Whenever you have a wheel, it represents a... is it clear why trees are represent formulas in Lie algebras? Basically, you know, if you have inputs, x and y, then the bracket, then the vertex will correspond to the bracket. So this will correspond to the function x, y goes to take the bracket of x with y, then bracket it with x, and then bracket it with the bracket of y and y. Oops, it's zero, but that doesn't matter. And so on. Okay? Likewise, wheels, which are labeled by x, x, y, y, you know, by the same letters, represent functions, and therefore element on the Lie algebra, and therefore elements in the symmetric algebra of the dual. The way this is a function on the Lie algebra is that, well, you see the vertex is the bracket. So this is a composition with bracketing with x, with bracketing with x, with bracketing with y, with bracketing with y, with bracketing with x, and then you fit it into itself, so you take the trace. So we're weaving, so this picture will correspond to the trace of add X, add Y, add Y, add, sorry, it's add X, add Y, add X. That's a function of the reality. So basically, trees and wheels represent functions and, well, represents stuff that you can make inside the universal entropy algebra of G tensor G, G cube.
Why do you say it's a function? It's just a number, no?
What?
It's just a number.
It's a function of X and Y.
Ah,
okay.
Yes.
So it's a function on two copies of Daly algebra. If you had three labels, it would be a function on three copies of Daly algebra. Okay? So diagrams correspond to elements of the universal enveloping algebra. So you can translate I want V inside U of IG tensor squared into I want V, which is a diagram of a certain type. It should be a diagram somehow on two copies of the universal enveloping algebra. These are these two arrows here. And then you can translate the algebraic properties that V has to satisfy to diagrammatic properties. I want these diagrams to somehow compose in a certain way. And that's statement number five. Okay? And finally, there is statement number six. And statement number six says that there is a homomorphic expansion. I will have to explain what a homomorphic expansion is later. It's a certain type of extremely natural type of an invariant. Okay? So I'm looking for a certain extremely natural type of invariant of trivalent W tangles. Again, I will have to explain what trivalent W tangles are in a minute. But they look a lot like knots, whatever they are. Okay? Now, if you want such a homomorphic expansion, it turns out that it's enough, given that I want it to be homomorphic, it's enough to define it on the generators. So it's enough that I tell you what the value on the vertex is. And the value of the vertex has to satisfy certain conditions. Well, this is a non-theoretic condition. You can slide a vertex from one side of a strand to another side of a strand. Okay? Well, I guess I lied to you. I also need to tell you what the value of the crossing is. Okay? So, to find Z, I need to find V and R, and actually a few other things that are shown in green, so I'm not explaining them. But the main things that you need to find is V for the vertex and R for the crossing that will satisfy a certain relationship which topologically corresponds to this picture. Okay, and the other ingredients should satisfy certain other relations that correspond to the pictures drawn below. Okay? But if you look at, if you translate this picture to what V really has to be, it turns out that V has to be a certain linear combination of diagrams of the exact same nature that I described here, and the equations are precisely the equations written up above. So in fact, if you look at this equation, it looks exactly the same as that equation. There is a vertex on, there is a vertex at 1 R, and here there is a vertex up above and 2 R's below it. And this corresponds to a vertex and 1 R and 1 V and 2 R's. As it turns out, the equations for R are trivial, there is a canonical solution. And so the only interesting part is to find V, and so I am really with the same equations. So that's the sketch. Are you more or less with me? I know you're not. It's horrible. What should I do?
Give an example.
Give an example. Oh my God. You see that the whole thing is like a sort of it's... Well, we'll get to it. Okay? We'll get to... Well, okay. Anyway, I guess I'm supposed to go backward now, and you know what, I do want to review the sketch, okay? So let me review the sketch and then try to go backwards and explain every corner in a little more detail. So again, the idea is we have a statement about convolutions. I translate, it's an integral statement. It's a statement about two integrals are equal. The problem is that they're written in two different spaces, so I have to, one is integral on the Lie algebra, the other is an integral on the Lie group. So I had to modify it and rewrite it using the group ring so that it became an equality of two integrals both written on the Lie algebra cross itself. Okay? So this is still in the realm of, you know, not theory. No not theory appeared here. Okay? Then I have to translate. Okay, then I said, rather than finding a... So I want to show that two integrals are equal. I show that the two equals are equal by finding a unitary operator that intertwines the two integrals, that maps, that pulls back one integrand to the other. Right? Whenever you have a unitary operator, when in fact a unitary operator is an integral identity. Right? To be unitary means that the integral before applying the operator, the inner product before applying the operator is equal to the inner product after applying the operator. And since we are in L2 of a space, that means an integral identity. So I'm looking for the unitary operator for which the corresponding integral identity will be the integral that I want. Now, a unitary operator on the Lie algebra can be described using words in the Lie algebra and its dual. Because, you know, elements of the Lie algebra differentiate and elements of the dual provide the coefficients, their functions. Okay? So I've translated it to a statement about I'm looking for an element in the universal enveloping algebra of the Lie algebra tensor is dual. Sorry, direct sum is there. Semi-direct product is dual. Now, in general, elements in universal enveloping algebras can be represented by trees or by diagrams. Trees and wheels or, you know, in the case of the other classes of Lie algebra that I mentioned before, it would be more complicated diagrams. But in principle, they can be described by pictures. So I'm looking for a certain collection of pictures that will satisfy a certain combinatorial identity. And finally, I argue that this is a non-theoretic statement, and in fact, this is the perhaps the most interesting part of the talk. Okay? So again, this is the sketch, and now let's go backwards from the knot theory to the statement about convolutions, and we'll go as far as we can. I don't know. So I want to tell you which knot theory we're talking about, first of all. We're not talking about ordinary knot theory. Okay? So, where was I? I think here. Do you need a comic interlude?
No.
Okay. If you need one, say it later.
Good,
okay. So, I want to define what are W trivalent tangles, but I think I want to do it by analogy with knots and links and with ordinary knots. So what's knot theory? Knot theory is the planar algebra, I will have to define this notion in a minute, okay, generated by a single crossing modulo three relations. Okay? So what's a planar algebra? Well, one can give a formal definition, and the formal definitions have been given. But I don't think I want to do it right now. First of all, Vaughan Jones talks a lot about those and shows that they're related to subfactors. But I think I actually first learned this notion from Ruth way before Vaughan Jones. But anyway, so a planar algebra is, well, instead of multiplying things along a line, you can multiply them in the plane. So things, objects in a planar algebra will be represented by disks with a certain number of legs, and inside the disk you have an object written. Okay? And then you can multiply three such objects, U1, U2, and U3, by specifying a way. So there isn't a single product, there are many products. And you just need to specify the way by which you glue the legs together, and for each way of specifying, for each specification of ways, for each way of specifying how the legs will connect, there should be a product in the planar algebra. So it doesn't have just a single product, but many, many products. One product corresponding, and some of the products will be binary, some will be trinary, some will be unary, but you have a product for each way of specifying how legs will connect. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, again, a formal...
You're not required to connect all the legs.
No, because there will be output legs. Okay? And, a formal... And there is some associativity condition. So, it doesn't matter what it is. Okay? A formal definition can be given, but it should be kind of obvious what you get if you look at the planar algebra generated by a single crossing. So the planar algebra generated by a single crossing, so really what I mean is that you have a single object, which you call the crossing, and really it's a little disk with a little picture inside it. The picture is sort of just my way of denoting this object. You could have called it X if you wanted. You know, if you wanted to be a real mathematician, you would call it X. Okay, but I just draw a picture. Now, what's the planar algebra generated by a single object? The free planar algebra generated by a single object? Well, you take this object and you look at all possible ways of multiplying it with itself. Okay, so it basically means you connect legs. Okay? So what you get is pictures of knot paths. So you don't get knots, you get pictures of knots. You get knot diagrams. Okay? And then you mod out by the Rademeister rules. So you declare that this picture is equal to this picture, and this picture is equal to that picture, and that picture is equal to that picture. But you see, these pictures are defined in terms of the generators. So this picture, for example, just says that x cubed, so the product of x with itself three times, is equal to x cubed, the product of x with itself three times, except it's a different product. Okay, the ordering of the way you connect the legs is different. Okay? So that's a relation that's a legitimate relation that you could impose inside the free planar algebra generated by a single crossing. Okay?
Can you explain the middle one?
Say it again?
Can you explain the middle relation?
The middle relation?
The right hand side.
This one?
Yeah.
So it's the identity, so no copies of x is equal to x squared. But it's not quite x squared because, you know, you have to say how to square x.
It's not like there's only one identity, or
So there are many identities. So this is the formal definition which I'm skipping, okay? But this is somehow the empty product. There are many empty products because you have a number of external legs and you want to put nothing inside, you can do it in many ways. You just have to connect the inside legs to each other, and there are many ways to do it. Okay?
But the planar armature can take many elements from the ends that are not connected to it. Also needs to take only the...
Right. Hence, I lied to you. And really, knots and links are the part of the planar algebra in which you have no external legs at the end. So after making the construction, you cut out everything that still has external legs. So you remove everything in which not everything was glued. Okay? So that's knots and links. Tangles are exactly what tangles are the thing that you get if you don't add the zero legs condition. So tangles are, when you want a picture of a tangle, here's a picture of a tangle. This is a tangle. Right? It's a part of a knot, but where the outside is not specified. So it's basically a knot with legs. Okay? Except here, I wanted to introduce trivalent tangles. So trivalent tangles have two generators. The generators are the crossing and a trivalent vertex. They have the same relations as before, except I dropped the first relation. It's customary to drop it in knot theory. Everything becomes more well-behaved if you ignore this relation. And you don't lose anything. I mean, I can explain why you don't lose anything, but it's not interesting. But then you have to add a new relation which has to do with the trivalent vertex, and the new relation called Rademeister 4 is the relation which says that if you have a lasso going around the vertex, you can pull it out, and then if you wish, you can then push it in back again going underneath the vertex. So in fact, this is the same relation that I had here drawn in a different way. It's the relation saying that you can slide something under a vertex or over a vertex. Okay? So now we understand what trivalent tangles are. Okay? Now, and for trivalent tangles, there is something in addition. So, trivalent tangles are not just a planar algebra, so they don't just have the operations of planar multiplication, of putting things side by side and connecting, there is an additional operation. And the additional operation is called the unzip operation. And what it does is, if you have two trivalent vertices somewhere inside, and they are connected by an arc, you can unzip this arc. Now, this arc could be knotted, and other stuff can go above or below it. Okay? But the topological unzip operation is still well defined, right? If you have an arc, no matter how messed up it is, you can always replace it by two parallel arcs which are infinitesimally close to each other in this manner. Well, they start infinitesimally close, but then they become topological and you can go wherever they want. Okay? So, trivalent tangles are a planar algebra with generators, relation, and further operations. Okay? Now, W trivalent tangles, or trivalent W tangles, are likewise a planar algebra that has the W generators, W relations, and certain W operations. Okay? Now, I think I want to deviate and change the order of things a bit. So, with your approval, only if you approve. So, the natural thing would be to tell you about the W generators and how they relate to four-dimensional objects. Here are pictures of four-dimensional objects projected to three dimensions and then to two dimensions. So I could tell you how W objects correspond, so how W tangles act what are the W generators, what are the W relations, and what are the W operations, and how they relate to four-dimensional stuff. And I will do it later on. But I think before that, I want to tell you, assuming you have W generators, assuming you have generators, relations and operations, what do you do with them? How does it become a combinatorial problem? What's a homomorphic expansion? What's the thing I'm seeking? Do you approve? So should I tell you the fun four-dimensional stuff or the heavy universal algebra first?
Fun
stuff. But the heavy universal algebra is somehow more valuable.
Mm.
This is sort of the topology is really a comic interlude.
Mm-hmm.
So should I do the comic interlude this time?
David,
you're my main sponsor.
You're
the
so.
Boss.
I don't think we can digest any algebra.
Okay.
An hour easily.
Okay, so let's do
it.
Okay. So I'll tell you what the generators, relations, and operations are. Okay. So first of all, on a completely algebraic level, the generators are little symbols in the plane.
Right.
We're in a planar algebra, so the generators should be planar symbols with legs. Okay? You know, again, you could call them X, God knows what, C, W, and Y, if you want it. Okay? But it's better to call them by little pictures. The little pictures are a little crossing, a little no crossing, so a little so-called virtual crossing. So this is a crossing in which you don't specify which one is over and which one is under. Okay? And then there is a line that ends in nothing. And there is a when. So anybody knows what's a when in English?
Mm-hmm.
I just learned it 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
So a when in English is some sort of an irregularity on the scheme. So basically, it's a line. In Hebrew, I would call it funkel or something like that. So basically, a when is a line with a certain blob on it. At the moment, which is marked with W. The meaning will be apparent later, or maybe is apparent already. And then there are two types of trivalent vertices. There is the ordinary trivalent vertex, or actually the singular trivalent vertex, whose symbol is three lines meeting in a point, and there is a smooth trivalent vertex, whose symbol is three lines meeting in a little circle. Line. Okay? So these are the generators. The planar algebra is anything you can draw on the plane using these basic ingredients, where you allow yourself to connect lines. Okay? Now let's move on and actually see what these things mean. Each of these things means a little thing in four dimensions. Okay? And, you know, I forgot to bring my props, and I always forget to bring my props. I have sort of little rings that I can use to demonstrate. And I sort of almost routinely forget them, and instead I have to make up my own rings. I need two more rings. This will work.
I will.
Okay. This doesn't connect. Oh, you know what? This will work, more or less. Here's another ring. I need another one. But that's not a ring, it's a line. Did you make it into a ring? Okay. So what I want to argue is that these little pictures correspond to two-dimensional objects in R4.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to look at R4, in fact, to tubes in R4. The best way to look at one way of looking at tubes in R4 is to think of it as a movie in R3. And then two-dimensional stuff or sections of two-dimensional tubes become rings. Mm-hmm. So tubes in R4 becomes rings flying around. Maybe I do need a better... okay, I'm just tight. You know what? I need a watch.
Here's a watch.
So two-dimensional things in R4 are movies of rings in R3. So let me demonstrate a few movies to you. So first of all, the movie corresponding to the crossing is the movie in which two rings trade places. But you know what? Maybe it's better to talk about the virtual crossing first. So the movie corresponding to a virtual crossing is the movie in which two rings trade places by just trading places side by side. Mm-hmm. But you see, this you could ask: do they trade places this way or that way? And the answer is that in R4 or as movies in R3, there is no difference because you can homotop this way to that way by going through an intermediate which would be above each other, that way. Okay? So hence, the usual trading places will be in R4 just represented by a vertex, a crossing with no over and under. Now, there is a nicer way in which two rings can trade places, and this is by one ring can go through the other. And now, there is a difference between one goes inside. There is a distinction between the two, and it's not the same as the other way around, topologically. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, I think my convention is that the bigger ring is the upper strand in the symbol. Okay? Now, there are also caps. So a cap is when a ring disappears to zero. So the movie corresponding to a cap will be a ring shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until it disappears. And therefore the picture is a line which ends in nothing. Okay? And there are also when's. I don't think I want to go into the when. I'll only tell you that it's fun. And it's a piece of a Klein bar. Okay? And there are also two types of vertices. There is the smooth vertex and the singular vertex. The singular vertex is if you have a single ring. Here is a single ring. It flies around, and then at some point it splits and becomes two. That's the singular vertex. It's singular. Locally at the split, it's not a smooth thing. There is also a smooth vertex. The smooth vertex topologically corresponds to a handle body. Okay? The smooth vertex looks more like, as a movie, it looks more like a ring flying. Maybe now I should make it bigger. Yes, exactly. So it looks like a ring flying around, then it gets thinner in the middle, and then it splits. So I guess that maybe it's better to do it with fingers. Yeah. You have two rings, or you have a big ring flying around, then it becomes two in this way, which is different than before. And I think that's all. But you see, I think I also want to tell you two more ways of viewing these objects. So one way is, rather than drawing the movie, you draw the tubes, and there is a certain convention for when things are below in R4, you make a broken surface. So this is another way of viewing it. And then there is yet another way of viewing these things, and this is by drawing ribbons in the plane. sorry, not in the plane, in R3. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll show you over here. So a ribbon represents a tube in the following way. If you have a ribbon in R3, so a ribbon is just a membrane with two lines at the edges. You can push, you can make two copies of this membrane and push the upper copy, or one copy, push it up in R4 so that it goes, you know, like that. That sort of, my hand moves to the fourth dimension in order to do that. And you can push it down in R4. Mm-hmm. And basically you can push it, you push it as far up or down as the distance from the edge, so that you get a cube. Mm-hmm. Okay? And then, this, for example, will become the interesting vertex, the real crossing, whereas this becomes the virtual crossing, and in fact you have this relationship that this is equal to that, that if you have two membranes, one above each other, two bands, two ribbons, one above each other, it doesn't matter if they go this way or that way. However, if they cross through each other, then it makes a difference. Okay? So these are the generators, and this is the four-dimensional topology that they represent, and there is a dry topology definition as well. Anyway, there are then relations. And the relations are actually trickier than you think. So first of all, there are Rademeisters 2, Rademeister 2, 3, and 4 for the... so, you know, basically if you have three rings, then in all three trade places, then it doesn't matter, well, if all trade spaces internally, then it doesn't matter in which order they do it, and also if they all trade places externally, it doesn't matter in which order they do it, provided they keep the relationship. So provided sort of the innermost is always the innermost, the middle is always the middle, and the, well, basically, so these are the Rademeister moves. And then come interesting relations. Okay? So there is one relation called overcrossings commute. Okay, so I guess what I want to say is that somehow the symmetry between over and under is broken in this theory. So there is an overcrossing commute relation which says that, you know, if you have two overcrossings going above a virtual crossing, you can pull them to the other side. But you don't have the undercrossing commute relation, which would be the same thing, but with the over replaced by under. And, you know, with the picture using ribbons, here is the picture. If you have a big ribbon and two smaller ribbons going through it and also trading places in the virtual way, then you can pull the big ribbon to the other side, you can just see how it goes. However, if you have a small ribbon cutting through two bigger ribbons, if you try to push it up, it will come up out the other way with a twist. Okay? You can also view it in the flying rings picture. So, you know, I'll skip it. I think I'm going too far. There is also a similar asymmetry for the other generators. So, for example, a cup can be pulled from under a strand, but not from over a strand. So, basically, the cup is my head, okay? The membrane, the other strand, so the membrane goes over my neck, around my neck, like this. I can pull my head down, okay? But if it actually went through my skin, I'd be stuck, okay? I'd be dead, okay? So this is this picture here, I guess. Okay? And likewise, there is a fun thing with winds, and likewise, there are fun things with the singular vertices. And I should say that this. So there is a certain topological definition here, and I've also given you combinatorics to describe it. So generators and relations. And in the case of ordinary knot theory, the fact that the topology corresponds to the combinatorics is the Rademeister theory, the theorem of Rademeister. So there ought to be a similar theorem for W knots. There is a similar theorem for W knots in the simplest case, if you remove all complications, if you do not consider the when and the cap and the singular vertices. So if you only consider crossings, and it's a theorem due to Blake Winter. Winter. But there is no formal proof written anywhere for the rest. So there may still be problems over there, though I don't expect any. Okay? Maybe I will say, should we take a break at some point? So maybe I will only tell you that there are also unary operations, like we had unary operations for tangles, there are unary operations for W tangles. And I'll just say what they are in a minute, and then we can take a break and, well. So, so there are two unary operators. One is you can unzip along an annulus. So if you have two singular vertices facing each other, you can unzip along the annulus.
The problem is somewhere as a quarter to two, I disappear.
Quarter to two, yes.
But it still disappears quarter to two, as some other people.
I obey orders. If you tell me not to
do it. No, yeah, just you do what you want. I'm just saying there's some boundary conditions over a talk. We can have 5 minutes break, but I think it makes sense to have 5 minutes break, but then we have short session.
Okay. So the unary operations are you can unzip, and you see what became two lines over here becomes an annulus one dimension up. So it's unzip along an annulus. And then there is a similar unzip along a disk. So if you have a singular vertex and a cap, you can sort of replace this piece of surface with two parallel copies, and it turns out that what you're doing is you're taking a disk and you're doubling it, and you get this picture. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's for the W definitions. So, I'll go on for two more minutes and then take the break. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, I told you what W tangles are. I still need to tell you what a homomorphic expansion is. And a homomorphic expansion is something completely, totally universal, which has nothing to do with the specific topology that I'm talking about. Okay? So, and that I will do after the break. But the point to keep, the point to retain, is that once I've told you what topology I'm talking about, and it's fun topology, what I do to it is something absolutely universal, which can be done to any algebraic structure of any kind. Okay? And then answering the algebraic question, the universal algebraic question, in the specific case of W knots, which is a certain four-dimensional topological thing, is answering a combinatorial question, which by a chain of equivalences or near equivalences is the Cauchy-Wyvern problem. So that's sort of that's my statement at the end.
Okay, so we start in 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
Yeah.
We must wait, I mean.
Yes.
That's the question.
מה?